Greetings and welcome to the Thirsty Mage, the podcast that profusely apologizes to the workers of at the employee throughout Costa del Sol. Hello, I'm David Lloyd, and yes, I'm the one that's been knocking over all the tables while scooting through the streets of the beach paradise on my Segway. This week is another deep dive into the world of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. This is episode, after looking at it, I'm pretty sure there's going to be six episodes. I believe there's five regions, if I'm correctly. Well, we're going to do all the regions plus one kind of wrap-up episode. So we're on number three, which is the Corel region. So this time we're picking up from the time that our toes touch the sand of Costa del Sol until our tears fall to the ground of Corel Desert. Joining me once again, still shaking out all the sand out of his shoes after spending too much time on the beach, it's Aiden Moore.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back. I live on an island, so being at the beach, kicking sand out of my sandals, it feels like home for me. And so does Costa del Sol, because going back to the original game, it was literally my home way back when in 1997.
Yeah. It's funny, Casey's the big Final Fantasy 14 fan, but... When I was playing, I still remember Costa del Sol being my probably my favorite place in Final Fantasy 14. So it was interesting to see it in Rebirth and see its how it looks. It's funny too, because the initial kind of introduction to Costa del Sol, it comes off as a very Hawaii theme, like with the people with, I think they got like Laos when you're getting off the boat and that sort of thing, but I was already on a high from the moonwalking Red 13 and the Queen's Blood tournament. Like the having that kind of intermission between the battling to have a fun tournament of Queen's Blood. I was just riding high and it kept on going. It's like, this game is just all highs. There's no peaks and valleys. It's just a descent up a mountain of highs. It's just incredible.
Yeah, it's wild getting to Costa del Sol, because, you know, the game, it's not very plot heavy. It's not very kind of linear in the way it tells its story, the same way that you know, the remake was. And so I've seen a lot of people sort of bag on the fact that it's the group spends so much time meandering and getting into these sort of, like, you know, low stakes situations. But I think that that's just, I guess because I have so much nostalgia for the original world, I really enjoy that part of it. And Costa del Sol, like, you know, you referenced it in your intro, but like ripping through Costa del Sol as Aerith on a Segway, like knocking everything over, just sort of feels kind of, you know, natural to the original game. And I think that, like, creating this world that you love to live in makes you want to save it. And Costa del Sol was just that. Like, there's no stakes for anybody in Costa del Sol. They're all having a good time. You know, it's not the slums. It's not, you know, later on we go into like the Corel prison. It's not any of those, right? These are people on vacation living in a coastal town, just enjoying themselves. And the party sort of leaning into that was fun. And the way that it contrasts, you know, Aerith and Tifa, like, you know, they kind of take that step back to gain perspective, and Barret's sort of like all like business, barreling forward. But I wouldn't have it any other way. And I think this region sort of exemplifies a lot of the, like, the original games, like, you know, sort of intense storytelling matched with just a lot of weird, like, sections that didn't really have anything to do with the story. And, you know, way back then they were just trying to show off like how cool the PlayStation was, but this game I think has really kind of like taken that concept and spun it off into a world that's just enjoyable to be in. And this section that we're covering today, up until, like, you know, I guess the final portion that we're going to talk about, really just like shows off how fun this world is.
Yeah, like it all feels well, it's fun. Like Costa del Sol specifically doesn't even feel like it's part of the world, because when, like, you go through, like you said, you go through Junon, and then it's like the wastelands there, and you see how the people live in Lower Junon, and then the grasslands was beautiful, but at the same time, like, you had Midgar in the background, and all the pipes and everything looks you know, dire. And then you get to Costa del Sol, and it's almost like nobody really even knows what's going on in the outside world.
They're just, well, and yeah, and
drinking margaritas.
Yeah, and it's like it sort of encapsulates the idea of sort of capitalist utopia, right? And even Johnny's Inn, which is like such a hilarious segment, like sort of really nails that home, because you had this sort of grassroots hotel that existed and was probably successful until Shinra moved in and turned it into this like high stakes, big money getaway resort town. And so you sort of see on the surface, it's really chill. You're riding around on Segways. There's a great beach. You get some swimsuits. But then, you know, even so, there's sort of that undercurrent of like, you know, this is still a gentrified, not even gentrified, I don't know what the word is, but like this is something that was taken from its original owners and turned into something else that on the surface looks glitzy and looks appealing, but in reality, you know, wasn't changed at the discretion of the people who originally, you know, settled in Costa del Sol.
Yeah, well, and it's even funny that Johnny Seaside Inn is like hidden behind crates. Like you have to walk through the crates, even to get there.
I saw the crack. Like I was looking around. I was, you know, I always poke through nooks and crannies, and I could see that like crack between the crates. And I was like, oh, we're gonna go back there later. Like, what's back there? You know, and you know, back when I was in my 20s, I traveled a fair bit, and like I stayed at some places that you know you had to crawl between crates to get to. But you know, those places also have to exist in a world, because there are people who, you know, who need that and like and enjoy staying at that place rather than the big glitzy hotel right down on the water or whatever. So it's like, you know, it's I really like that Johnny is such a funny character, and for him to sort of have his like salvation by the end of that storyline was really satisfying to me, especially because I don't think you can buy the Costa del Sol house, right? So in the original, you could spend $1 million and buy the big house that has Costa del Sol's name written on it, and it would become your house. And the house, it's there in this game, but you can't buy it as far as I know. And so like Johnny's Inn sort of becomes like the proxy for that experience. And I think like later on, after we finish the portion that we're talking about today, I think it becomes sort of like a bit of a like second home for the characters. You know, you can store your some of your collectibles there, I think. I'm not that far yet. Yeah. I don't know for sure, but I'm from what I can tell, your collectibles go there and stuff. So it's nice that they kind of added that in there and kind of gave it a storyline that, you know, that fit in, and it was zany and it was funny, but it was also, you know, gave you something to do in Costa del Sol instead of just ripping right through, which I don't think would have been very satisfying.
No, and Costa del Sol itself is like just this big conglomerate of mini games. It's just from every region, and it does a terrific job of just not taking it very seriously. Like the whole point of doing these mini games is that you're you need not money, I guess, but you need to earn tokens so that each of the characters can get an outfit that's acceptable to be worn on the beach, which is, you know, kind of
like,
funny.
Yeah, you're not even allowed on the beach until you have like a nice swimsuit or whatever, which is pretty funny. But it also led to like one of my favorite sequences in the entire game so far, which was Tifa and Aerith's date. And so, you know, at one point you just, you know, Cloud's kind of done his thing, and then Tifa and Aerith go out, they call it a date, they go around playing mini games, trying to get these tickets to get their swimsuits, picking out swimsuits together. And it's just like, it's really joyful to see the game kind of explore their friendship outside of, you know, their relationship with Cloud. And it's just, it was fun and funny to see them, you know, just spending that time together. And I, like, skipping ahead a little bit, like, we'll get to the date part at the Gold Saucer, but like I found the date sequence in Costa del Sol a lot more satisfying and interesting than the date sequence in the Gold Saucer, which is like, you know, one of the big moments people were sort of looking forward to. And there's like whole mechanics to go into the Gold Saucer date. But it sort of fell flat. And in part because we had this like really likable, funny, sweet extended scene with the two women.
Yeah, and it's funny that there's like some light consequences to the choices that are made too, because depending on whether the swimsuit matches what Cloud's wearing, it can affect your relationship with the girls, which is hilarious.
I was so mad about that when I got the wrong, I made the wrong choice. I matched up, I wanted a date with Aerith, and I matched up Tifa and Cloud, and I was like, do I reload my save? I was like, no, I can't do that.
It was pretty far back too when you get Like, it's not just like a few minutes behind. It was probably like an hour or two back. So
yeah. Like, I would have had to have gone back quite a bit. That's right.
Yeah. So there's a bunch, yeah, like we said, a bunch of mini games that you have to play to earn the tokens. Yeah. Is there any in particular that you found more fun than the others?
None. I don't know. I really like the mini games. Like, and I know some people are really people are divided on the mini games. I think that they're like, they were an interesting part of the original. I think they're good in this one. Some of them are good. Queen's Blood remains great. Some of them are bad. Like the, you know, Red 13 playing Rocket League, which, like,
that's pretty funny
in concept. I think it was good, but his controls are so tanky. Like, he takes so long just to, like, turn and, like, pivot, and you're trying to hit this moving, like, relatively small moving ball. And I found, like, I just didn't have the, like, fine control I needed over him to, like, get myself to knock the ball in the direction I wanted it to go. And, like, I don't know, the shooting mini game, I couldn't invert the controls, so I just, like, it was torturous to me. But what I really liked, actually, so there was one that I really liked. I really liked that they introduced sort of the gimmick matches to Queen's Blood. I thought that was really cool.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Rather than just straightforward Queen's Blood, they become little puzzles, essentially. And I really liked that. It was just an interesting take on the game that made you think about the cards from a different perspective, but also kind of taught you higher level techniques and higher level ways of thinking about sort of the strategy within the card game.
Yeah, and it forces you to update your decks. Like, yes. I know there's like five or six slots that you can make decks, but I think I pretty much rode the same deck for.
Yeah,
I would tweak it depending on, you know, what cards I picked up at any given time, but I pretty much kept to the same deck. But there it was like, no, like you have to make changes.
Yes,
you have to utilize the slots and tailor it to those specific conditions in those matches.
And you know, like, there are cards now that destroy opponent's cards or your own cards or get stronger when cards have been destroyed, and you know, I probably generally would have stayed away from that. I find that I'm fairly defensive when I play Queen's Blood, but those matches force you to engage with those cards, and then I ended up creating a deck that was focused on, like, being aggressive and destroying my opponent's cards. And I was like, oh, there's, you know, there's a lot of, you play the game in an entirely different way. You think about the game in a different way based on the style of deck you played. So the fact that they had those sort of gimmick matches and then they come back up later on at Gold Saucer, I just, like, I really like that aspect of it. I think do you have to beat one of them? Do you have to? I can't remember. It was a little ways back. I'm not a fan of when they force you to play Queen's Blood, because I think that can be very challenging for some people. But I do like that's there.
Yeah, I enjoyed the callbacks to Remake with the characters. Like you said, we got Johnny in, so we're helping Johnny out, which is a great throwback. Like, I was playing the original Final Fantasy lately, and just realizing that Johnny is just like a throwaway character from the first game.
Yeah. But he is in Costa del Sol. Like, he does show up there.
Much more important in this game.
Yeah. Much more important. And I mean, like, that just exemplifies the whole Remake project, right? Like, they took all of these aspects that in the original game were sort of like caricatures or like abstractions of other, you know, ideas or personalities. And you sort of, like, you know, they gave them a little bit of screen time or whatever, but this game really, like, builds on those and turns Johnny into, like, he feels like the same Johnny from the original game, even though the original character didn't really have anything to him at all. And the way that they kind of build out and fill the space within all those sort of abstract ideas from the original, just, it works from, like, a metatextual level on the story and what they're doing with the story, but it also works on that sort of fine detail level of, like, yeah, Johnny would be hustling in Costa del Sol trying to start an inn, right? Like, I have a friend who's down in Mexico, like, hustling, selling timeshares and stuff, and I'm like, yeah, like, those two remind me of each other. Not like my friend's not goofy like Johnny is, but, like, that sort of drive to, like, you know, find something, you know, find a crack to fill and sort of, like, you know, become great at that. I think that's what Johnny wants to do. That's what my friend wants to do. And I'm like, yeah, that makes so much sense for Johnny.
Yeah. And I loved the whole sequence. So when you finally get your beach attire and you're allowed down on the beach, it's Cloud's reaction to the girls is pretty funny. But then I laughed out loud when Hojo came down with an entourage.
Yeah.
Like, this seems so out of character, but I love it because it's just hilarious.
Absolutely.
He's talking about them being his assistants and stuff, and then all of a sudden, I don't know where the black robes are getting turned into the monsters, and he's just finding it hilarious.
And then I like how you can talk to the, you know, his entourage later, and they're like, "Oh no, we didn't like him. We were just doing our job," like, which is pretty funny. Yeah. The whole, I can't really remember how the Hojo thing plays out in the original, like, in detail. He just kind of shows up on the beach, doesn't he? A little bit. Like, it's not an extended sequence, is it?
No, I don't even remember. I think he was there, but I don't remember like a fight or anything. It was just like he was just kind of there.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years since I played the original. Yeah. And I was surprised that it turned into, you know, like such a big conflict with them. But they had, you know, again, like filling in space kind of requires them to add tension, you know, add stuff like combat. And like, how great was it when Cloud
realized he had no sword?
They set that up like he had to leave his sword behind. They have a whole scene of him like putting his sword away and stuff. And then like when he grabs at his sword and it's not there. And then he grabs
the umbrella.
He grabs the umbrella. And it's just like that level of like humor is so funny. And it's like, I also like that it like doesn't impact him in combat, right? Like, he's not all of a sudden useless. It doesn't become a gimmick fight where he has like useless physical attacks. It's just funny, right? Like, the game just doesn't take itself too seriously in moments like that. And those moments of levity, I think, then get, you know, really allow you to lean into sort of the melodrama that fills other parts of the games. Which is really
well cool. And then the levity continued when Yuffie somehow manages to clone Johnny.
Yes.
And she doesn't even herself know how it happened. It was just like, I have ninja skills. And she's like, well, I don't know. Like,
she has no idea.
Think about it. Is basically the.
It's so good. Yuffie is incredible. Like, she's so good. As like, the fact that she was like an optional character in the original game, and they've turned her into one of the most sort of charming and charismatic and like appealing characters in this version of the game is remarkable to me. The way that she, like, and I really like, you know, she finally joins the team for good in Costa del Sol. And I like how they sort of inverted it on the original, because in the original you have to encounter her a few times, like you have to sort of like bait her out to like join your team. She's reluctant to join you, whereas in this game she's like following you around, like trying to join your team for hours, like for so long, and Cloud's just like, no, like, who are you, go away. And then like, finally sort of like reluctantly brings her on board, and she's so happy. I don't really get why she's there. She just wants materia, I suppose. Oh, she wanted to join Avalanche, right? That was like the DSP.
I guess it was kind of because initially she was in Junon, and I know there was like the assassination attempt on the Rufus there, and it almost felt like I guess she was just trying to get away, and then but she did have that admiration for like the splinter cell of Avalanche from Integrate. So when she finally met up with them there, I think there's a little bit of hero worship there. And then when she saw them kind of in action, it's like, okay, like clearly, you know, these are the guys that I should be around. And there's some funny interactions where she's standing at the corner, in front of the big building there. And, like if you talk to her, there's some funny lines between her and Cloud.
Yeah. She's so good. Whenever you bump into her, like for her optional dialogue out on the street, she's always worth talking to for sure.
But even the trek up Mount Corral where, they convince her to go up there, it's usually they just tell her there's materia and she'll go along with whatever. But, having her and, Barrett, kind of, I think Red 13 was the other one that they all went ahead, and I always laughed at like I guess it was supposed to be like chalk that she was leaving for Cloud.
Her pictures of Barrett were so good. That was fantastic. And just again, like another layer to Yuffie as like, you know, an optional character who is sort of like, you know, outside of a little side quest, and then, you know, character animations in the original, she didn't really have a personality, but they like somehow managed to like take that small little nugget of personality and turn it into something that felt like fleshed out and a whole, and those little diagrams just add to it, right? Like, she's just having fun in a way that, like, you know, contrasts so well against Cloud and Barret, who are not having fun ever, right? Yeah. Aerith is having fun. She has a twinkle in her eye, but she's also very, you know, quiet and sort of reserved in her personality. And Tifa is, you know, also sort of reserved and tentative in a lot of interesting ways, but doesn't have that big bursting outward personality. And Yuffie just brings that aspect to the team that I think was probably missing in the first one. You got it a bit in like Biggs and Wedge and Jessie, and she sort of fills that role as well, right? Like these kind of boisterous personalities that don't need to drive the narrative along, don't need to carry sort of the emotional punch for the story, but provide the balancing side to those things.
Yeah, lights up the room whenever she's in it, that sort
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I guess before we go up Mount Corral, there's a pivotal moment, I think, in the story where I think it's right before Tifa and Aerith kind of go on their date, where Red 13 is in Aerith's room and they discuss that her white materia has gone clear.
Yeah.
And because I remember in the first episode, I think we had talked about how in yes. Remake, it really seemed like Aerith kind of at least had an understanding of what was happening, that yeah. the story was changing, that the Whisperers were trying to keep the original story the way it was going, yeah. and were kind of getting meddling, I guess, with the new direction. But she mentions that the Whisperers had stolen the, I guess, like the essence of the materia, and that's when Red 13 explains that basically the materia kind of holds the world's memories and mm-hmm. and thoughts. So that's kind of I felt like that was the developers telling us that it's a clean slate. Aerith doesn't know what's going on.
This yeah, it's like this Aerith doesn't anymore,
yeah.
right? But then, you know, again, skipping ahead a little bit, there's later in the section that we're talking about today, there's, you know, flash sideways, to like use a parlance from Lost, yeah. where we sort of go into the other timeline. And Zach is taking care of Aerith and Cloud, and you can see her white materia is there, and it's full, it's cloudy, it has all its color. So, like, that white materia, obviously anyone who's played the game knows the white materia is important, but it very obviously plays a different role in this story. And the way that you have sort of these two, this, like, bifurcated path for Aerith. I'm curious. I know you're near the end of the game. I'm not. I'm just up to the end of the section we're talking about today. I'm very curious to see where that goes yeah. and what they do with it.
Nothing. What's funny is that there hasn't really been any mention of it again since. But I know yeah. the. I know in the end game of the
yeah.
the very finale, there's going to be something.
Yeah.
I've done some very. A lot of dancing on social media every time I yeah. see anything yeah, I know, in yeah. relation to the final. Yeah.
All I know is it's kind of divisive.
Yeah.
That's the
only thing I've heard. Because yeah. I immediately close the whatever browser yeah. I'm in if I see something come up.
That's where I'm at too. Yeah. The other weird thing about that scene, and I guess like any scene where Cloud sort of like, you know, spies on Aerith and Red 13 is Red 13 talking in that child's voice. Like, and what that's all about too. And I, you know, like the original didn't have voice acting, but it's interesting to kind of see them carrying on, you know, a relationship that's like private to them, and they both sort of have these secrets that they're holding on to that they're sharing. Yeah. You know, and the idea as well that Red 13 is, you know, she's confiding in him as somebody who it sounds like she's looking to for sort of advice or perspective. And what does that mean for Red 13 and, you know, any sort of, you know, knowledge that he might have of what's happening or what's going on. I always go back sort of to the very end of the original Final Fantasy VII, where you see, like, you know, the very, very final shot is like Red 13 and some little Red 13 cubs looking over Midgar as it's been grown over by the planet again.
Yeah.
I wonder like with the Red 13 stuff, and how that sort of ties back into some of his story in the original game, but I might be totally off. You might know more than I do. And
yeah, that is directly addressed. Soon.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
It's like the Cosmo Canyon stuff. Like, you find out a lot about Red 13. And you do find out in the original that he's like younger than everybody thinks he is or something.
Yeah. I'll leave it at that.
Fair enough.
But yeah, no, Cosmo Canyon is a region later in the game, and it's kind of I would say it's kind of like his time to shine, would be the way I'll put it. Yeah.
He definitely like has taken a back seat in this game so far. Like there's, you know, he's kind of tagging along, but doesn't really have a whole lot of impact narratively.
No, he's usually kind of in the background. Whenever they stop, he's usually hiding from kids and stuff.
Yes, that stuff is so good. Whenever they want to pet him and stuff, like I do like that.
Up until the moonwalk. I'm so glad they left that whole sequence.
Was so good. And like, again, like just going back to the game, like the game totally could have like left all of that out, right? Like it could have been embarrassed by what the original was. But it wasn't. It leaned into it and is so much better for it. You know, like Red 13 playing Queen's Blood and like wandering around as a sailor or a, you know, a soldier. Or a, what are they called in this game? They're not soldiers because soldiers are soldiers, capital.
Troopers, I think. Yeah.
You know, that's just great. It's fun and it's funny and it shows sort of like just the respect for the original that wants it. Wants to like celebrate what it was, not, you know, what it might be if it was made from scratch in 2024.
Yeah. I think for the most part, it's easy enough to skip the Mount Corral stuff because I felt it was kind of miserable to a certain extent.
Yeah. The whole thing where like, the best part was when Aerith was like winded and that was just cute. Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, how like she would,
grappling around as you see, as soon as you split off from them. This whole section could have been cut out if they needed to. Yeah. But
I did like that they had the minecart game in there because I like
that was fun.
You know, it was sort of like when the original came back. That was not long after like Donkey Kong Country, and its minecart games and stuff, and it had that silly little like minecart sequence in the original. So I was glad that was in there. But yeah, the whole like grappling around, like lowering the bridge, that part was. Yeah, I don't.
Did you set up the route for Barret or for Yuffie?
For Barret, of course.
Oh, really? I went with Yuffie. I don't remember why, but I just remember thinking maybe I was trying to even out the factions because I know she was a little bit behind. So right. I'm like, yeah, I'll give you a break this time.
She's way behind for me. I didn't even clue in that would have an impact on the the relationships. And so like after the end, like Yuffie was like, you know, mad at Cloud, and then it was like, this affected your relationship with Yuffie. And I was like, oh, like positively. You know, like I think she actually had fun going off the big jump. But
I read a funny story about I guess the voice actor for Yuffie was so good at making throw up sounds that they actually had to dial it back.
God,
he said it's just a little too real. We gotta dial this back a bit.
Caricature of throwing up, not actual gagging, wet gagging sounds.
I would say the best part of that whole sequence was Cloud Jr.
Cloud Jr. Which was Cloud Jr.?
Oh, the little chocobo with the hair.
Oh my gosh! Yes, yeah. Yes. And I love how they like, you know, they first met Cloud Jr. and who was it? Tifa and Yuffie were like, oh my gosh, it's Cloud. And then like, you know, half an hour later, you reunite with Cloud and Aerith, and Aerith is like, huh. And she like comes to the same realization like on her own, without having to be keyed in. That was a cute little callback. I liked going up, and I liked the first trek up like the gondola run in Mount Corral, like that part where you get split up, like, and maybe that's just because, you know, like there's a ski mountain close to me, so it kind of reminded me a bit of home, climbing up the mountain, just like a unique environment in like a RPG to be climbing up. But but it also like everything from like the bottom of Mount Corral to getting to the Gold Saucer did seem a little superfluous, especially because like everything from Costa del Sol to that point was so enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Well, even like the village of Corral, I felt like I kind of blew through it because
me too.
I saw the sign for Golden Saucer and I'm like,
There's a bit to do there. I guess I played some Queen's Blood matches and did a little quest.
Too much. Like the doctor, you get a bit of a storyline of where it's explained that that's the doctor that that ended up saving Tifa.
Saving Tifa, and then you find out later he also saved Barret and like grafted Barret's like, which like, man, that's like an advanced medical technique, like for like a backwater doctor to be performing twice, because he probably saved Dine, so he probably also knew that Dine was alive. But the North Corral stuff, like I like that they put these little mini villages throughout the world. You know, that's been a criticism of past Final Fantasy games, like, you know, 13 just didn't have towns and stuff. So like the fact that they put these little communities here and there that have, you know, mini quest lines and stuff, I think it's good. It's like North Corral was not my favorite part of the game. I didn't stay there any longer than I had to, but I was happy it was there.
No, I would say the main draw of this region is definitely the Golden Saucer. And I remember I saw an interview with Katase, and they were talking about how they really wanted to make this like an attraction. Like, I think they were going like, we want to make this like the Disney World of the of the Gaia, or what, I guess it, just this incredible, and it blew my expectations out of the water.
It's big, like it's glitzy. It's like
it's so big you need a Moogle to teleport you around, because like it just takes too long to walk everywhere.
And I like that they leaned into that, right? Like, I like that they made it feel vast instead of making it a little more convenient. Like, they could have made it smaller. They could have made it easier to get around or connected the various regions, but like they didn't. They spaced everything out so each place could have its own spectacle. And then, of course, it was all interconnected and seamless, right? If it had been closer together, everything would have been butting up on each other. And those like slidey walkways are just
It was fun. like kind of these I don't know, they're like conveyor belty, but there's like no actual belt. It was just like, no, we're just gonna zoom you up here. That's all right.
It's like, you know, those trains that use like magnets, like
I guess that'd be kind of,
it's like the same thing, but you're the magnet. You just like kind of hover along at hyperspeed. It's pretty fun. Like, I could have used the Moogle to get around, but I didn't, because I liked those things. Like, I just want to go on one in real life. It's like the airport. You know, you're at the airport and they have conveyor belts along the ground, but they're slow. And these ones are fast, and fast is fun.
And I love the whole sequence at the beginning where you get there and there's like the song and dance, and Yuffie just, you know, joins in like it's nothing. And
then with her like costume and stuff.
That's right. She's in a costume. And then Cloud's fighting Dio, and it's like the original polygonal look and everything.
Good. Yeah, that was great. Yeah. Dio is so funny. He's like so big and burly and muscular. And I like how, like, you know, you fight him and he's in his little, like, you know, wrestler underpants and his cape. And then I like how, like, you meet him later when there's been, like, you know, a shootout in the lobby. You know, there's a guy on the lam, like, and he's still just wearing his little wrestler underwear. Like, you know, like, he didn't go put on a suit. He didn't go put on anything else. He just, like, is always in his little underwear and his cape. And that's just great. Because, like, frankly, if I looked like that, I would probably go everywhere in my underwear and my cape, too. Like, why wouldn't you, right?
Yeah, I love when they go back, jumping ahead a little bit, but when they go back after a certain sequence, Dio is still wearing everything, but he's bandaged up.
That's so good.
You gotta go back, because he's got like a Band-Aid on his face, and he's got amazing. Like his arm taped up or whatever.
And he's still in his underpants, right?
Yeah, he's still in his underpants.
That's like, so good.
And they even call out for him, like, are you okay? And he's like, well, you know, I'm fine.
He'll persevere.
But yeah, the amount of detail in here, I guess we'll start with like the mansion. So when they initially get to the Golden Saucer, everything's booked up. And this is where they meet. I would never have guessed that it was pronounced Kate Sith. I think I was like made fun of for, you know, back in the day for pronouncing it that way. But that's the way the game went with, and Kate helps hacks into the hotel system, which is a hilarious sequence where he ends up taking the Turks and I can't remember that guy's
Palmer.
Name. Palmer. They take the reservation and switch it over.
So good.
Yeah.
During that sequence, he seems to have, like, it's almost not like he's hacking in, but he has some sort of level of authority and access, because later on, Cloud and Co. are, like, denied access to a back room area, and then the guy, like, gets a call from Kate Sith saying like, oh no, these guys are good, like let them through. And it's like, oh yeah. Okay, like he's not just a weird cat thing. I mean, he is just a weird cat thing with a Scottish accent. Welsh accent?
Yeah, Scottish. Yeah, I mistakenly called it Irish, and, yeah, and I was like, no, Scottish. Yeah, totally Scottish.
Yeah, which is funny because, like, you know, I don't know if this game goes into it, but when you find out sort of like what the deal with Kate Sith is, it's like, why does he have a Scottish accent? Like, nobody else has a Scottish accent in this game. So, like, where would it come from? Like, if somebody has a Scottish accent, like, they need to come from a place with Scottish accents, right? Like, somebody else has to have a Scottish accent. But I thought that his sort of like ephemeral, like insistent introduction as he sort of like sort of forced Cloud into like taking his help was really good. Because in the original, he's like even stranger. It's like, why, yeah, like, why is this guy on Cloud's team? Like, yeah, this doesn't make any sense. Whereas in Rebirth, he's sort of like, he has things that Cloud needs, and Cloud sort of can't, yeah, proceed forward without Kate Sith's
well, help. They certainly seem more willing to trust him in this game than, yes, I felt like in the original. Yes. So
totally. Yeah. And I think that's because he was offering them more, right? Yeah. In the original, I felt like he was a little more like, you know, you'd be like, why is Cloud going along with this stuff animal? Riding a bigger stuffed animal. It's like, it's, yeah, strange.
And I love the detail in the hotel room. Yes. With all the Tonberry stuff.
A little humidifier.
Yeah, the humidifier. Yeah. I love too, there's a door next to the, yeah, door that leads outside. And, yeah, if you open it, there's like a picture of a Tonberry painted, yeah, onto, like, it's almost supposed to be like a surprise of like, you, yeah, open the door and the Tonberry's gonna like knife you.
Yeah. But like, I like how the game keeps it's like trolls you, right? Like a little bit, like you click, yeah, on things and stuff. But like the worst thing, the scariest thing, the most awful thing in there is you open a treasure chest and then you get one gold saucer point, but yeah, nothing, everything is in increments of, I think, 10. So, yeah, like you just perpetually have
one,
151, 386, yeah, like 11 gold saucer points. You can never get rid of that one. And it drives me insane, and it's obviously intentional and makes me laugh, yeah, every time I see it in my you know, my balance there, because it's like, you know, there's the Tonberry behind the door, there's, you know, the handprints on the wall, there's the genie bottle, and then there's just like the mimic chest that gives you one gold saucer, yeah, and that's like the most cruel thing in the hotel. But yeah, I thought that the hotel
very was clever,
beautiful, yeah, also. I, yeah, think the game, like,
oh, and the receptionist that comes down from, yeah, the ceiling,
drops down and scares everybody. It was so good when the Turks showed up. Yeah. And like Elena was like just lost her mind. Yeah. And then, but then Rude is just standing there, like completely like unstartled and, yeah, totally stoic. And it's just like, oh, this is so
he's
good.
He's probably been there.
He knew what was coming. Yeah, for, yeah, sure. Elena's fabulous in this game. She's so, yeah, good. Another one of those characters that, like, you know, kind of played an archetypal role in the original but was fairly flat, that they've sort of like expanded into something that's far more interesting and just feels like a real person, right? Like the Turks, yeah, in the original were interesting because they had their own motivations. They were sort of like flawed, or, you know, not just completely linearly driven in their motivations. You know, they sort of help out sometimes, or they turn, you know, to look the other way. And that's very complex for an older game. Like in 1997, that was unusual to see. But I think that they've taken those things from the original game and not just made them, you know, actions, but also kind of imbued that in the Turks themselves, as you kind of see that more of their personalities.
Mm-hmm. So this was the point where we have our initial date with someone. Yes. And who was it with for you?
It was Aerith, my girl Aerith, which I was quite happy about. I got about halfway through the date before I realized it was the date, though.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
She knocked on the door and I was like, oh, there's Aerith. Let's go check around. But yeah, and then I took her on the most awful date of all time, which, like, I, you know, I was saying earlier, the Tifa and Aerith date was so good, yeah, and like felt like, you know, them hanging out. Whereas this one, it was like Cloud was like walking in front of Aerith, like, 9 feet in front of her the whole time. And like, I spent more time talking to like Tifa and Yuffie and like Madame M than I did like actually talking to Aerith. You know, I got shut out at the Chocobo races. The play had ended, you know, it was just like, this is not, it was such a unique time in the original game. And I feel like for me, it fell a little flat in this game because you don't get the carousel ride, which is like the best part of the date, right? Well, I mean, maybe later you do.
Yes.
But at this stage, so you sort of like, you're wandering around, the two of you, and like Aerith has some cute things to say. But otherwise, it just kind of like feels like Cloud doing his thing. Like, you know, when you're in high school and you don't know how to be around, another girl or another boy, like you're out on a date, and you're kind of like, don't really know what you're doing. Like, and I guess that fits Cloud. He didn't really, I think, realize it was a date. But who did you get?
I got Aerith as well. I think the thing that I find clever with this, and it's easy now because I've done the other date, is it does a terrific contrast of where Cloud is and where he ends up, because it's so much of a different experience.
I
think that so looking back at it, I'm like, oh, the fact that it was so awkward is actually kind of awesome.
Okay. Because, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I can see how they would play off of that, because Cloud is awkward, and it felt awkward to me. It didn't feel satisfying, but if it's not the culmination, that opportunity
for growth is there. Completely different later on.
That's
fun.
That's cool. I wondered, like, can you take Barret on a date at this stage? Because, like,
I almost wonder if you have to take Aerith in this one. I haven't. Yeah. Unless somebody else someone else at this.
Yeah, one of my friends got Tifa.
Oh, and
he actually got Red 13 by accident, and then rolled back to an earlier save to like juice up Tifa's relationship so he could get Tifa. So you can definitely get Tifa. You can definitely get Red 13. I don't know if you can get Yuffie. It doesn't seem like you could possibly build up her like
not in the first one. I don't think. I know in the second one you can literally get anyone.
Right. Okay.
And I've watched them all, and some of them are so ridiculous.
Well, the Barret one was really good.
I killed myself laughing.
That's awesome. I'll have to do that after I kind of get through.
Yeah, I had to wait till I saw the first one. And then I guess that's the other thing, is the affection points make a huge difference in the later one, because there's different, like there's a potential date for anyone in the party, but then there's also like different levels of the date itself.
Oh, interesting.
Based on the affection.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. So I had mentioned to Casey, there's a couple, I'm sure we'll get to it later in the other episodes, but there's a couple quests that I would actually recommend people do before they go on that date of that second date, because, you kind of have to do these other side quests that aren't in the main story that will boost the affection for that meeting down the road. So
so you're trying to like maximize the date potential, not just who you
get, that's right, but like that's right. So it's definitely worth it.
I remember like when I got my, because I got a review copy a little early and it was under embargo, and like one of the things I wasn't allowed to talk about were the date mechanics, and I was like, well, like, you just halfway through the game you go on a date at Gold Saucer, like what could really be like the big deal? But it's cool that they recognize that was a really appealing part of the first game for a lot of people. And like this game, I feel like more than almost any other like console RPG, especially of the time, really leans on character relationships to like drive forward its, you know, emotional beats. And so the team, once again, I just think really understood what made the original so appealing to people, which is remarkable, because, you know, they have a team of people who, you know, some of them worked on the original game, and then they have a bunch of younger people who grew up with the original game, and those people would have very different ideas of what was good about it. And the fact that they just like nailed everything is I still can't quite believe it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, I know there's the whole, like, some people who grew up with the original are very, like, Clarith, like, you know, Cloud and Aerith are supposed to end up together.
Yeah.
But after, like, other games have come out, and and even in Rebirth and Remake, I feel like in the original, it was much more ambiguous of, like, which, you know, what relationship were they really, like, canon or whatever, however you want to put it. Like, who was he? Who were they really pushing him towards? I feel like Aerith was much more at the forefront there, whereas in this one, it feels like they're really lining up Tifa as the companion to Cloud, I guess we would put like I don't feel that same tension with Aerith the original.
Even in this date, the first date, like, Aerith's role isn't sort of like, she's never wooing Cloud, right? Like, she doesn't really come across as though she's like enamored with Cloud. She finds him sort of amusing. I think she carries a lot of like love for him, but it's in a way of wanting to sort of like help him grow. Like, again, like going back to this idea that like in the first game, it seemed like she knew what was going on. And like, if she knows the big twist is coming, I could see her sort of being like, okay, well, you know, my fate is what my fate is, and I need to help Cloud see what's right in front of him, what he's had in his life this whole time with Tifa. Yeah. But on the flip side, like, he also, like, there's a lot of baggage between him and Tifa. Like, he's telling all these stories, and Tifa's like, what the f***? That didn't happen. Like, that didn't happen at all. That's a lot of baggage to work through for two people.
Well, and at the same time, at this point in the game, Aerith doesn't know the fate of Zack.
Yes.
For those who've played Crisis Core, I guess you wouldn't have known this in the original if you just played the original. But in Crisis Core, like, Zack and Aerith have a relationship.
Yeah. That as like you say, as we've gotten sort of a more expanded look at all of this, like, Zack and Aerith feel more real. Like, they have a long history together in a way that Cloud and Aerith don't. And Cloud and Aerith sort of have, like, a fun chemistry, but not necessarily, like, you know, like a deep-seated, like, filling the hole in each other's soul, that's shaped like each other or whatever, in the way that, Cloud and Tifa have all of these shared experiences that they can kind of go back.
Well, and with this game too, now that you have the alternate timeline, it's actually like showing that that closeness, where Zack is like, I guess I don't want to get too much into it because I don't remember. I'm so far into the game that I'm like, oh, I'm not sure where the story's come and go. So I won't say too much about that.
Well, I just play that part. And what you see is like sort of tension between Zack and Aerith's mom in that flash sideways, flashback, whatever. You can tell that there's sort of tension there that Zack has this like intense level of care for Aerith that wouldn't be just like, you know, he met her, he has a crush on her or whatever. Like, there's something more there. And the way that he sort of like, despite, what is Aerith's mom's name? Elmira?
Elmira, yeah.
Is that Elmira?
Yeah. It's Elmira. I'm almost
positive. What's Marlene's mom's name? Anyway, in any case, Aerith's mom, like, you know, sort of pushes Zack away when she first finds Zack caring for Aerith. And she says, like, oh, look at her. Like, you know, you're not doing a good job. She needs to come back to my house. And Zack's like, whoa, you can't do that. They're staking out your house. But he goes with her. He continues to follow through and refuses to sort of be, you know, pushed to the side. And I think that shows that, like, depth of relationship that they have
At this point, like, this is kind of new territory for that relationship, because in the original game, Zack was dead at this point. So now you've got Zack alive, and you've got this new story in that timeline for Cloud and Aerith.
Yeah.
And then it's still ambiguous of like what's going on with Cloud, because everyone seems to know Cloud differently than he knows Cloud.
Yes. Well, and like, Cloud and Zack have a relationship going back as well, right? Yeah. And like, that has yet to be sort of explained how that's going to play out. And it's interesting, in the flashback in this portion, you see Cloud in a wheelchair, slumped in a wheelchair, which is obviously like, you know, a big part of the original game that I don't think makes it into Rebirth. But I wonder like how that all sort of melds together in the end. Like, it's not an accident that they put him in a wheelchair. Comatose in a wheelchair in that alternate timeline with Zack. Like, that's obviously an intentional callback. But does that replace what happens in the original, or is that sort of in concert or in parallel? Like, how are they going to blend all of this together? I have a lot of faith that it's going to come all, you know, come together, but I don't have all the threads I need to really unravel that yet.
Even where I am, I don't know what.
Yeah.
Like, it's they're really saving it to the end, I think.
Yeah. So
I've seen some cutscenes, yeah. but I still don't really know where they're going with it. So,
yeah, I hope they get the next game out quick as well. Like, yeah. I don't know, waiting for a lot of, you know, answers. Cause, like, you know, the second act of a story doesn't usually ever provide answers, right? Or if it does, it sort of provides red herrings, it increases stakes. It sort of builds up towards the end game. So I'm not expecting Rebirth to provide answers, right? Yeah. I'm expecting it to sort of create more questions before I get to the end, but I'm really going to want whatever the third game is. I thought it was going to be
called... I can't even imagine waiting for Return of the Jedi back in the 80s.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I think that's a like that's fabulous the feeling example, I'm right? Yeah. Yeah, Empire Strikes Back sort of like, you know, it answers some questions, but those answers just create, you know, five more questions.
Yeah, exactly.
And I can see the same thing happening here with Rebirth, that, you know, by the end it's like, oh, okay, here are all the ways that they've changed things. Here's some stuff that was addressed from the original game, but like, for everything that's addressed, you have like, you know, six more new question marks about where things are going next.
Yeah, and so after the Golden Saucer, the region.
How did you like the games in the Golden Saucer?
I enjoyed it. Like, I was going all over the place. Chocobo's Racing is hilarious because there's actual standalone games of Chocobo Racing now, which I hadn't actually played before.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's right.
But it feels very Mario Kartish.
Yeah.
So that was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Even down to like the mechanics, like you can do the. What do they call it? Like the drift?
Yeah,
you can drift mechanics,
which is great. Yeah. I like that a lot.
And then, I gotta watch what I say here because things change later when I go back to the Golden Saucer. Yeah. Like, opens way up.
Interesting.
Yes, there's.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
I am shocked at the amount of racetracks they have in the Chocobo Racing when I go back.
Right.
And all of the mechanics with the there's like multiple chocobos and like it's just crazy.
But oh yeah, like when you get to you kind of get to actually race after you leave the Gold Saucer and go down to the Coral Prison. Yeah. And it's like there's a tutorial and it's explaining all of these like, you know, mechanics, and you can outfit your chocobo with different costume pieces and they all provide different abilities and this and that. And I'm like, okay, cool. And then none of that applies in like the story required race where I like, you know, like
won
by a mile against the best chocobo racer of all time, who like in the original was like, Joe was tough to beat. Like he was genuinely hard to beat. You had to breed chocobos like, and eventually you would beat Joe. And in this one, it's like, I didn't have to do any of the mechanics and stuff that they talk about. And I beat Joe by like, you know, a quarter of a lap. But I was like, okay. I guess it becomes something bigger later. No, it sounds like it does.
Yeah. Then there's like the Queen's Blood. There's like a rail shooter spaceship thing.
That was weird.
Which was really weird. Yeah, and I'm just like, where? Every time I'm playing another mini game, I'm thinking like, when did they have the time to make all these things? Like this game was done in 4 years and there must be like 400 mini games in here. Yeah. Like it's incredible.
I can see them just like handing that off to like, you know, basically like game jams, right? Like internally, like especially among like younger developers and stuff. It's like, okay, we need the boxing game. We need let's replace a submarine game with like a space fighter game. It's like, who can make the best one in 4 days? You know, and just have a game jam over a week and come up with a bunch of mini games.
I can see like Katase just kind of walking through the building and then like somebody sitting at a cafe and I'm like, no break for you. Yeah. Get upstairs and make me a boxing mini game.
I feel like, this whole series is interesting because they put so much work into remake that they were able to repurpose for this one. And from the sounds of it, like hearing Hamaguchi talk, it sounds like they're able to take a lot of the groundwork now created for Rebirth and bringing it into the third and final game. And like, I feel like it's such a testament for keeping teams around, right? Like keeping the people who created Remake around to work on Rebirth. There's just that institutional knowledge, there's experience, there's excitement, there's an understanding of how the game mechanics work that just kind of creates an opportunity to, in a relatively short period of time for modern games, create one of like the most content filled games I've played in a long time. And I wish, and I hope people look at games like Baldur's Gate 3 and Rebirth and say, okay, like these games did something right. And now how can we replicate sort of the studio experiences, the business decisions that went into to allowing these teams to make something pretty magical, you know, within limits that were, you know, smaller than other teams, right? Like whether that's, you know, I'm sure the team on Rebirth was huge, but the timeline wasn't very big. And I doubt, crazy, right? For a game this size. I doubt, you know, like Larian's studio size is probably not that big for Baldur's Gate 3 compared to an Assassin's Creed game or whatever, right? And so, like, you know, look at a game like Rebirth and say, how did they do this? Like, how did they make all these mini games? Well, they were also making an entire huge, gigantic world and all that other stuff. How did they do that?
What are they, 10 plus years now for Grand Theft Auto 6?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Long time.
Well, and then, yeah, like, with the third installment, like, they have so much built already. Like, I don't even know, like, it doesn't feel like they would have to add too much. Like, they could just take what they got now and just, you know, make some new quests, build the story. Like, I don't even feel like they need to add a whole lot more. It kind of reminds me of the Like a Dragon experience where, you know, you might be walking around Yokohama and Kamurocho for the fourth, fifth, or sixth time, but you still love it. Like, it's there's new quests, there's new story. Like, it's, you know, why not just reuse it? Get me, you know, get a game out every couple of years. And
I think it's becoming pretty clear that, like, AAA game development as it stands is unsustainable. Like, we just can't keep scaling up infinitely in terms of like complexity and size. And so looking at ways that we can sort of, you know, reuse environments or reuse mechanics or, you know, assets to create games that are, you know, creatively different and differentiated without necessarily having to rely on building everything from the ground up again, I think is going to be really important going forward.
Well, if they want to keep building games based on all these Final Fantasy VII models and environments until the day I die, I'll be happy.
Me too. Yep. Absolutely.
But yeah, I guess the end of the region takes place after the Golden Saucer. So there's basically a shootout in the Golden Saucer where a man with an arm, a gun for an arm, kills a whole lot of Shinra troopers and employees. And Dio, I think it's clear that Dio knows that, like, you're not involved or whatever, but kind of thrusts the responsibility on the Cloud and the party to, you know, find out who it is. And underneath I can't remember what they call it, but under, oh, it's like the Corral prison, I guess.
Prison,
that Gus is one character.
I like him because, like, you know, he's pretty funny as soon as you meet him, right? He has a really distinct mannerisms, way of speaking. Then he sort of falls into the, like, one of my least favorite, like, story building tropes, which is where he sort of, like, utters, like, vague threats of sexual violence against Tifa, Aerith, and Yuffie, which I was, like, pretty unimpressed by. But then, like,
it doesn't feel like he's serious, though.
No,
it's all undercut.
And then it gets undercut because when you win the Chocobo race, you can see that, like, Aerith and Tifa and Yuffie and Kate Sith and Red 13, like, they're all partying at the bar with everybody else. Like, you can tell that as soon as Cloud walked around the corner, that Gus guy was like, okay, like, he's on his way. Come on out. Let's go have a drink. Like, let's go have some fun and watch Chocobo races. And so, like, I felt like that was a pretty good way of, like, reversing and undercutting sort of a trope that I was like, oh, why did they go there? Like, that's so cheap. And it was like, oh, okay, no, it's actually, like,
you know, making fun of it, kind of really
clever the way that they did that. Cloud is just so serious and would dislike somebody like Gus so much that he would sort of be like, he would take him at face value, right? Like, Cloud would totally believe whatever Gus said or threatened. Even though Gus, and, you know, it's like Gus almost, like, read him right off the bat perfectly.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's a little bit of fear of. I'd be a little worried about pissing off a guy like Cloud, but.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I love, like, then when you're in Kuril prison, there's like, you have to go get these like greens, right? For the choke. There's a chocobo that you need to race, but he's like out of energy. So you need to get some greens. And there's these little mini quests. And one of them, you sort of like into a back alley and you get funneled into like
the lion game. Who's lying?
The lion game was good. Yeah. The lion game was good. But these thugs like kind of funnel you back into like a little battle arena. Oh, they're going to like rough you up. And then like you destroy them. It's a really easy battle. And then at the end, they're like, why didn't you just tell us that you're way out of our league? You know, like, and it kind of shows that like, you know, there's all these ruffians down in Kuril prison, but like, you know, Gus doesn't have any real power over, you know, somebody like Cloud, right? Like,
well, it's funny because they're playing up like how dangerous it was going to be when you go down there, and but then when you actually get down there, it's not nearly as ominous as it was made out to be.
Chadley's like hanging out down there, and like, I think that what the game does really well, and what it's always been interested in, is showing how communities come together under difficult circumstances, right? Like places, you know, you might have the Sector 7 slums or the Sector 5 slums, but there's still communities full of like real people with real relationships, real families, real lives. And Kuril prison was the same in this game. It's like, like this is a harsh place to live, but you also see how they kind of come together to create something out of that. And I think that the game has always been interested in looking at opportunities to show that that level of depth in the world.
After you have some fun with Gus and win the chocobo race, they tell you that the man with the gun is in a shack out in the middle of the desert. So after you head out there, they all pretty much know it's not Barrett, but they also don't know what the hell's going on. So when they get there, it was a heartbreaking scene in the original, but man, did it really. It was a knife to the heart in this game when you finally meet Dine. And the whole sequence between Barrett and Dine and watching like it all play out. And I guess when you see, like, because there was the whole time, it was funny because Yuffie was kind of saying the things that you're thinking when you're there, and everyone's like giving Barrett a hard time, and Yuffie's like, why don't you stand up for yourself?
When you're going into like North Kuril, right?
But then the story is explained, like how Barrett was on board for getting money from Shinra, and how it led to the death of the village or whatever. And you see it in the original with like the little polygons and stuff, but when you see the two of them like getting shot repeatedly on the side, and then adding Scarlet to it, I think was a neat touch.
Yeah, that was interesting. Just sort of creating that another layer of antagonism to Scarlet, who is becoming one of the not less likable. Like there's a lot of intentionally unlikable villains in this game, like Palmer, but Scarlet, you're just like, she's just bad, right? Like she's very competent and very good at being a villain. And that sort of just adds to that. It adds, it's like you see her sort of being authoritative in a funny way when she's using like a trooper as a footstool in the first game. And then this shows that like she doesn't just sort of like sit back with her layer of authority rule that over people. She actually also acts in a way that an effective villain would act. And I think that was interesting to see that sort of real dedicated expansion of how she led to like Barrett's particular circumstance.
Well, and it gives Barrett and Yuffie a common ground, like that. One of the things that helps to build their relationship through,
right?
Yuffie's like, we're gonna get her, but you don't get her without me.
Absolutely. I had a thought about that, all of that, that I can't remember. anyway.
But yeah, that sequence with Dine is so painful, especially when Barrett's like, we can go see Marlene right now.
Marlene.
Yeah.
I think that's such a good payoff for the Marlene and Barrett relationship over the two games. Because, you know, we had played the original. We knew who Marlene was, but Barrett does have a daughter. That's a very important part of who he is, why he acts the way he does. Like, his motivations are very wrapped up in Marlene and providing a better world for her. And, you know, she refers to her as his daughter, and that's it. But, you know, over the course of Rebirth, you see, like, even deeper how much he sort of cares for Marlene and how much he wants to do right by Marlene. And you get to the Dine scene and they connect the dots and you say, oh, hey, Marlene was Dine's daughter that Barrett adopted. And, like, Marlene is, you know, he cares for her as a daughter, but he also cares for her because he feels like he failed Dine and he can't fail Dine twice. And I think that's such, like, such wonderful payoff to kind of have that all dovetail into, like, such a highly emotional, well acted and well, you know, like, well choreographed and directed, like, sequence of events that punctuates so much of what Barrett wants and who he is. There was, like, an article recently that was kind of going around social media that people were sort of dogging on a little bit, but it was like, it was talking about how, like, Final Fantasy needs black characters who aren't just jokes. And, like, I just couldn't really get there with Barrett in this version of the game. In the original, he was a caricature and an archetype in a way that wasn't really fleshed out properly. But I think that the writers on this game were really aware of how they needed to make sure that they added depth and complexity to his character so that he didn't just come across as sort of like a comic relief, like, oh, he swears a lot, oh, he's angry all the time. Like, they show so many different sides of him to ensure that, like, you know, he isn't just put into, like, typical sort of stereotypes about black characters in video games. And so I just really couldn't square that with Barrett in this game and this scene in particular. I'm like, I just see it and I'm like, that's like the heart of Final Fantasy, right? Like, Final Fantasy VII is, you have Cloud who's on his own, like, weird journey, but Barrett, like, exemplifies the sort of anti-capitalist, pro-environment messaging that creates the foundation of all of Final Fantasy VII's story, and seeing the emotional turmoil that he goes through and how that turned him from somebody who was, you know, shilling for Shinra into somebody who was, like, putting everything on the line to destroy and defeat Shinra and create a more equitable universe or world for his daughter is, like, that's pretty compelling. I think that's, to me, that's where the real emotional heart of the game's narrative lies.
Yeah, well, it just shows you why it's so important for him to save the planet. Like, he's not trying to save it for himself, he's trying to save it for Marlene.
Yeah.
And then you see these, like, layers of, you know, it's not just because it's his daughter, but it's again trying to make up for these failures of the past. And and you just see the buildup as these story beats are unveiled.
Cloud has that great line when Dio's like, oh, it was your friend who shot up the place, look at this poster. And Cloud's like, it wasn't Barrett, look at the security cameras. He was like, Barrett wouldn't shoot the security cameras because he would want people to see what he was doing. Like, he isn't holding back. Like, he is going out there and he wants people to know that he's the one, you know, putting his life on the line to save the world. A world that, you know, like, a lot of people are enjoying, you know, all of the things that Mako and Shinra provide. They're happy to turn a blind eye on, you know, the entropy that lies underneath it all, which is, you know, that's what Final Fantasy VII's message is. And I think that's more relevant now than it was in 1990.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 1997, sure. Right? Like, and it's remarkable that, like, 27 years ago, this game came out and, like, I was playing it as a 13-year-old and I was like, oh, this game's so sweet. Like, and, like, no idea that, like, 27 years later, it would be, like, you know, really foundational to the way that I kind of perceive stuff like capitalism and environmentalism and the relationship that we have with the planet. Like, I think a lot of that can be tied right back to Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, like, arguably the late 90s might be, like, the kind of most joyous of society, really.
Absolutely,
like,
you
know, back then there was, nobody was thinking, like, there was, you know, it was the most peace I think there's ever been in the world at the time, like, you know, at the time, I guess, but the economy was doing great, you know, and it was reflected in kind of media too, where it's like, it just feels like things have changed so much since then that it's funny that the message hasn't changed that much, but it's more relevant now than
It's wild to me.
Almost 30 years ago.
The one funny thing that I find though, like, is that, like, this scene also, like, goes into, like, you know, dying, being opposed to, like, the Mako generator, and Mako sort of represents, in the late 90s, it represented, like, nuclear power, right? The opposition to nuclear power, and, like, Dine is, like, banging the drum on the coal machine, the coal train. He's like, yeah, we gotta ramp up coal production, save the planet. And, like, that, you know, so, like, they got the details wrong, right? Like, you know, they weren't quite his heart was there, but it is pretty funny to hear him, you know, going on about coal in this game and how it's going to save the planet if they just start burning more coal. And I'm like, I don't know if he was quite on point there, but that's,
well, I kind of like the idea that the world was changing and they didn't, and they were kind of both wrong, because if they had a wit with dying, like, then the village would have died, like, because you know, Mako was taking over, so all the jobs would have went either way. So it's like it's one of these, like, there was no right answer, like, they were just doomed, you know.
And that's kind of what capitalism does, right? Like, it forces people onto bad paths, right? You have, like, you know, two paths forward and they're both bad. Like, what do you do? And Barrett tried to ride one, and then he realized that the only choice was to say, no, I'm not taking either of those paths. I'm forging my own way and I'm coming for you. And I think that's so, like, just all of that is exemplified in the Corel region. But specifically, like, you know, the Corel prison and then going to find Dine. Like, it's just like after Costa del Sol, after Junon and the boat ride, after all the Johnnies running around, like, all of that stuff is so lighthearted. And, you know, even the Gold Saucer is really lighthearted and funny. And then all of a sudden you're just sort of hit in the gut by this Barrett story. And it's like, it's such a, like, dramatic way to sort of, like, remind you that, like, oh no, there's, like, it's not all sunny and shiny and nice on the surface. Like, there's so much pain and suffering out there that's just hidden away from, you know, the privileged in this world.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, that probably will take us to the, we're pretty much at the end of the region. What a way to end that one. And we get to, it's funny because technically a lot of the region's blocked off until this point, because when you, so, you know, Dine, there's the whole death scene with Dine, and then you fight Shinra a bit, and then Dio gives you this this buggy, which is really, really neat, and that kind of opens it up. But I would argue that the areas that are opened up are more for kind of the completion of the intel and the Remna waves and that sort of thing.
Right.
The story doesn't really pick up again until you go to the next region, which is going to be Gungaga.
I'm amazed that you get the buggy. That's another one of those things in the original game. Like, you get the buggy so you can cross rivers or whatever. And I could just see a remake skipping that, right? I could see a remake skipping the tiny Bronco later or whatever, and like the fact that like they give you the buggy is
well, the mechanics another one are of those things hilarious, like, too. Trying to drive up walls and getting into funny situations,
like the Mako, was it called the Mako in Mass Effect? I think it was. Same thing, like just a funny buggy to like drive around. But but yeah, the desert's funny because, like you said, like a lot of the region is locked off, and you don't get there until sort of the end of this chapter. But you have a quest that isn't a desert, right? The Johnny quest line wants you to go into the desert. And Johnny's like, oh, it's a big pool of water. I don't really know how to get across that. And I'm like, well, I could probably just swim. I can see the other side. Yeah. But you can't really get there. And fortunately, somebody had kind of tipped me off. Too many, way too many twigs. That's right. Somebody had tipped me off that you can't actually get there until you proceed in the story. But I could have, like, there's a real chance that I would have run around for an hour, like, looking how to, you know, into how to get across there. Because up to that point, as soon as you found a quest, you could just complete that quest. They hadn't sort of had gated off areas. So that was kind of tricky. And Johnny tells you you can't go over there, but, like, it's also Johnny. It's
that's the thing.
Many Johnnies. I wasn't necessarily going to believe him. But.
No, I think I spent about 45 minutes trying to figure out how to get to the southeastern end of the map. Yeah. And then I decided to Google it, and I'm like, crap. Okay. Yeah. I do have to do this. And this region is the first region where you just can't do all the quests because there's two proto relic quests that are locked until the final chapter.
Oh, interesting. I haven't done as many of the quests in this region as I was in the previous regions.
So you can do everything except two proto relic. Once you get there, you know, just move on to Gungaga.
I'm so curious.
What's annoying though, is the game doesn't specifically, like, they do say, the game says you can't do it right away, but they're not clear. Like, is it one of these things where I just got to run around for a bit and, you know, in an hour it'll be unlocked? And it's like, it truly is like, you're not getting here till chapter 12.
So it would have been nice if they'd, like, maybe, you know, made a slightly different icon to say, like, hey, here's a, you know, here's a proto relic quest, but it's locked off for now. You know, like, just the version of the proto relic icon on the map, but, like, with a circle and a line through it or whatever to basically be like, hey, you can't actually access this yet.
Yeah. Well, and it's not even, it's at the end of chapter 12 too. Like, I'm at 95% of chapter 12 done.
Yeah.
And then the guy calls me up on my little gun cell phone or whatever. He's like, those quests that you've been wanting to do for the whole game, they're unlocked now. And I'm like, thanks.
Thanks, bud. That's good stuff. I'm excited to see what happens in Gungaga, because that was a optional part in the original game, but it's obviously important to Zach and his storyline. So I'm curious to see where that sort of takes things. Gungaga was like, I always liked it. I liked that little village in Gungaga that you can explore. And obviously, that's usually where I would get Yuffie as well when I play through the original. So I'm curious to see how they sort of integrated into the story in a way that's, like, you know, unskippable going forward.
So I guess upcoming episodes, we'll have we're going to take a couple weeks off because I think some people, Jordan, he didn't quite get there for this episode. So we got to give him a couple weeks to catch up.
I was frantically trying to get to the end of that chapter 8 today.
Exactly.
But yeah. And like, I think I was saying off air, like, I've got 55 hours in the game. Like, I've played Rebirth more than I've played Remake at this point, and I'm still halfway through.
So in a few weeks we'll have a Gungaga episode, and then that'll be followed up with I don't know if I should say the regions. There's another region and then another region. So that's three episodes, and then I'm pretty sure it's unlocked the that's it for, like, unlocking regions. So we'll have a fourth one that'll kind of wrap up our final thoughts on the entirety of the game. Well, and probably a lot of talk about the ending and what we think will be coming in the third one or whatever. So we'll have four more episodes coming up throughout the coming months, I would probably say. I don't think we're going to tackle so many all in one sitting like we've been doing lately. So Eden, if there's anything you'd like to plug before we wrap it up here.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've got a book that I think fans of Rebirth will like. It's called Fight Magic Items. It's a history of Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest, and the rise of Japanese RPGs in the West. It's available wherever you can buy books, like at your local bookstore in your town. If they don't have it on the shelf, they can order it in or anywhere else. I also have a newsletter that you can keep up with my work and other books and things I'm working on, as well as, you know, discrete issues and essays and interviews and all sorts of fun stuff. That's called Astrolabe. You can find it at astrolabe.aidenmoher.com. It's free to sign up, and it's pretty fun. those are probably the best places to find me. I'm no longer on Twitter. I am on Blue Sky. But
Under AidenMoher.com, I believe.
AidenMoher.com, that's right. Yeah. That's me on Blue Sky. So you can find me
there. I just figured out how to make my website my name.
Yeah, it's once you know how to do it, it's fairly easy. And it's such a great form of verification because it shows that, like, you know, it's not an arbitrary check mark that somebody in support gives you, like old Twitter, and it's not, you know, like a badge of dishonor that you flaunt for $8 a month like it is on current Twitter.
Much easier to tell someone too, instead of like the username .bluesky.whatever.
Exactly. I've been trying to find like a good URL that I can, like a domain I can buy that's like, you know, funny or a pun based on my name or something better than AidenMoher.com.
Yeah.
And I will get one, but I haven't found anything too good yet.
Yep. Well, yeah, in the meantime, yeah, you'll be able to follow Aiden there, and we'll definitely have you on for future episodes.
Anytime.
Yep, exactly. So I guess it's one of our longer episodes in a while, which is nice. So hopefully everyone enjoyed our Final Fantasy VII Rebirth talk this episode. And yeah, I guess we'll see everyone out at the next Thirsty Mage. So for now, bye.
Bye.